tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Just received news of the Katina ceremony that they're having in England. Katina is a ceremony that takes place in Theravada countries or non-Theravada countries that have Theravada monasteries from the full moon of October to the full moon of November, where the lay people, and that marks the month after what we call the rains retreat. So the July, August, September is called the rains retreat, which comes from the time of the Buddha. During the monsoon season, the monks couldn't wander, and so they were encouraged to stay in one place because of flooding, because of crops growing and whatever, and then at the end of that period they could wander again. And before they started to wander, there was a month called the Katika month, where the lay people could come and offer robe material. Monks could sew a robe and then they could wander again. And that was quite a practical consideration, because the monsoon season is very damp, and the robes would have been pretty old and would have rotted or whatever, so it probably has quite a practical background to it. And then this ceremony called the Katina ceremony has evolved, and the Katina itself, if I have it right, is a sewing frame. And if you've seen pictures of people doing a big quilt, say maybe 10 women doing a huge quilt, they'll pin it out on a big frame, and then they'll all be kind of sewing it together in the old days by hand. Well, that's the way the monks would put a robe together. They'd have a frame. They'd somehow put the bits of cloth that they had onto the frame, porcupine quills or something, not sure how they do it, and then they'd stitch it up. And the ceremony then evolved so that the lay people would offer cloth to the monastic community, and then the cloth was offered in the morning of the Katina day, and the lay people chose the day of the week they wanted to offer the cloth, and then they could offer other requisites, food for the larder or soap or things like that. So it became and is a day of gratitude, a day of offerings. Then that the offerings usually take place in the morning or just after the meal, and the one piece of the robe material is very special, and the monks will take that piece, which is the Katina robe or the robe material. Some monks will take and they'll take it away to the sewing area and start sewing a robe. And then they have to finish sewing that robe by the next dawn. So it's quite a beautiful ceremony, because what happens is all the monks in the community try to participate in the sewing of the robe. It's sometimes a bit wonky, because you get 5, 6, 10 people sewing this robe, but it has a very harmonious feel to it. Lovely sense of harmony, because everyone's doing this together. They've just done a 3-month retreat together, and then at the end of the sometime in the evening or into the night, then that robe which has been sewn, that one robe, is given to a designated senior monk. It might be the abbot, it might be one of the senior teachers, and the Bhikkhu Sangha then comes together and offers that robe formally to the senior monk. And then that sort of completes the ceremony. In many Asian cultures, the sewing of that robe is done by lay people. In the forest tradition, the monks do it. So sometimes the lay people will offer a robe that's already been sewn. In Burma, say, like our robes are made of, they're supposed to be patchwork robes. And in Burma, they have a tradition, the more patches you have, the more merit there is. So they'll sew these robes with like 200 patches on it. It's just little square, almost like a quilt, you know, it looks like a quilt. And they'll have a great time doing it, just because there's a sense of goodness and wholesomeness and so on. Our forest tradition then is one where we're given this cloth, and then we go and sew the robe. The requirement for a sort of formal katina ceremony is it four or five? Four bhikkhus, and then you can bring a fifth. Four bhikkhus have to spend the rains retreat together for it to be kind of official. Those are sort of legal matters. But quite often in a small monastery where there aren't four bhikkhus living together, they'll just have a sort of almsgiving ceremony at that time, at the end of the retreat. That's one of the big ceremonies in any Theravada culture, and it's quite joyous. So returning to Ajahn Sumedho, their katina at Amaravati, the katina at Amaravati will be on the 14th of November, and they're expecting 2,000 people. They're planning for 2,000 people. And the king of Thailand, he's not coming personally, but a representative of his, I think, one of the princesses in that, or someone in the Tyrell family, will be offering the robes. Will offer, I guess it would be the robe material, and they'll sew it up. So it's for Ajahn Sumedho, it'll be the last kind of official ceremony of his abbotship at Amaravati, and his long service in England, and then he'll go back to Thailand and then teach or do whatever he wants to do. So I think there'll be a lot of tears and a lot of laughter and a lot of joy. And the day before, that'll be on the 13th, the Sangha of monks and nuns will come together and formally ask for forgiveness, which is one of our ceremonies that we do. We go to the senior teacher, to the abbot, and then there's a formal offering, asking for forgiveness. The teacher in turn asks for forgiveness. And this is a very beautiful ceremony that we a ritual that we do in our monasteries. So it'll be a very, very powerful time. And I just got a postcard from him, and he was in Mallorca. He really gets around. But I think for him must be very, very, very moving time. All this lovely sense of gratitude's coming up. We have a Malaysian friend not in Kuala Lumpur, another town in Malaysia, who has printed up some booklets, some CDs, some photo album of Ajahn Sumedho's life, and a booklet and CD of his teachings. So it's quite a little package they're going to be giving out on this Katina Day. All the monasteries will be giving this out. Najan Manindo sent me a note, and he's actually organized 2,000 shopping bags with gratitude written on them. He's got style. He showed me. So we'll actually we'll be getting these booklets and things also. And I forgot to mention, I thought, perhaps if we thought we could post them to our mailing list, it'd be nice. We can talk about that. Anyway, all to say, we're part of a very large tradition where there's tremendous devotion and energy in this kind of practice. We're kind of out in the boondocks here, but we're doing well in our own small way. So that's. Thought you'd enjoy learning about that. So I need to say something about Buddhism now. can't keep bluffing like that for long. So perhaps we could. I've been contemplating balance a lot in my own practice. I'll share that with you maybe. I remember a talk that Ajahn Sumedho once gave on Samma Samadhi. Samma Samadhi is usually translated as right concentration in the Noble Eightfold Path. And I remember him giving a talk as it being a balanced emotion, which is a completely different way of kind of approaching that. And so I was pondering, thinking about that balance and samadhi. So concentration always sounds like, well, something you're focused on. You concentrate on what you're doing, but and obviously that's a part of training the mind. In when we talk about samasamadhi, we always think about, for just the groundwork of our life, that we live a moral life and that we live a life of generosity and responsibility. So that's always a given, but one shouldn't forget that that's very important. But also then, in terms of samasamadhi, we talk about hindrances, and hindrances are a way of thinking about imbalance, and the hindrances, I like to look at them in three areas: energy, emotion, and intellect. And so the five hindrances are classically described as restlessness and dullness. There's a pair. And I like to look at that as energy, balance of energy or imbalance of energy, love and hate, or aversion and fascination. I like to look at that as the emotional part, and then doubt as the intellectual part. So if we look at, say, the love-hate part of our conscious experience, if my mind, kind of carrying on from what I was talking about last week about the khandhas, if my mind is continually absorbed into, distracted by, fascinated, repelled by the emotional, mental, physical experience of being human, then that constant fascination or distraction prevents me from realizing the transcendent peace of the heart. And love and hate do that. I like something, I want to get it, I want to own it, I want to hold on to it. I'm averse to something, I try to get rid of it, avoid it, blame someone for it. And I could see that if my attention is always preoccupied with love, hate, then the attention is not free. It's not free to look at any deeper possibilities of consciousness. It's always preoccupied with these things. So the imbalance of a mind which is just driven by love and hate, that's an imbalanced mind. Now, it needn't be immoral. It's just a mind which is always distracted. So to say, like, if you just think about something simple, like, let's say you make a mistake, you made some bad investment in your stocks. When was it? 3 years ago? 4 years ago? And now your stock portfolio is like 50% what it was. Or you bought some piece of equipment which you really thought was going to be just what you needed, and then you realize you didn't notice something and you bought a lemon. Or you said something to someone which you perceive was hurtful to them. Something negative in your life. We all have it. Now, when that negativity, the memory of that comes up, it has a certain feeling to it. It's not a nice feeling. It's not a loving feeling. You have a kind of aversion there. And if you're not aware of that, so let's say I remember investing in Nortel. 8 years ago or something, right? I actually met a man who invested in Nortel just as it was crashing and it started to go down. So he put more money in to make up. Well, if I put more money, I'll get back. And he did that four or five times. Lost a bundle. Okay, so let's say our Buddhist investor is now sitting 8 years later having to work hard. And then that memory of that will come up. He'll see something in the news, something, someone in the family will make a crack about his investment intelligence, or so that memory will come up, and that memory is unpleasant. It's not a pleasant memory. And so the memory is both in narrative and in feeling, because we are feeling beings. And if there is imbalance, so if there's a lack of awareness, if there's a lack of strength of awareness, if there's imbalance, then that negative memory will then trigger a whole bunch of thinking. Shouldn't have done that. You know, that's the wrong thing to do. They shouldn't have done that. And that triggering and that my attention being involved with that means that my attention's not free. I can't plumb the depths of peace that's possible in the heart. Why? Because I'm still caught in the surface of thought, which is triggered by this negative thing. And if you're observing your mind, how much of our memory can have negative things in it? It doesn't have to be huge. It can just be like a little mistake that you made yesterday, you know, some little piece of speech which was unskillful, at least perceived to be unskillful. Memory comes up, triggers off a negative feeling. Shouldn't have done that. Or someone spoke negatively to you. Memory comes up, negative. They shouldn't have done that to me. So the mind gets preoccupied with thinking, and then maybe, you know, you find yourself thinking like that, and then you think you shouldn't think like that, and it gets more complicated. So you could see how that would be imbalance. Why imbalance? Because the mind is preoccupied. So if you look at balance as not being preoccupied, just knowing this is a memory that has arisen, it feels this way, and the mind doesn't engage with it with thought, and it ceases, then attention is free. Simple enough. And the positive, so you have something you want to own, you want to do, or someone you want to see, something which you keep thinking about. Maybe it's you might be meditating and you're a bit bored with meditation, and you remember you've got Chinese duck. My mom has Chinese duck in the fridge right now. That's why I mentioned it. And you just, you know, your mind could just be remembering something sweet to eat. And so there might be a pleasant feeling coming. Oh, it would be nice to have that. Nice to do meditation. And the mind keeps thinking about that. So the lack of balance is the preoccupation with something which it would be beautiful to have. It might be something creative. Maybe you're creating something and your mind just goes off into this lovely creative fantasy, because that's quite pleasant. It might be a puzzle. It might be whatever. So the arising in the heart of that pleasant possibility triggers a whole bunch of thinking, and the lack of balance, samasamadhi, lack of balance, keeps you tripping off into this pleasant thing you're going to do or plan or have or whatever. And so if the mind and this sort of love-hate spectrum that we have never knows the pleasant as pleasant, the unpleasant as unpleasant, just as objects, then that's micha samadhi. It's imbalanced, not right samadhi, because it's not balanced. So if you think about how we do something like metta practice, what do you do there? Well, you evoke a feeling of open-heartedness quite deliberately. So you evoke the image of someone, something, an animal, a person, doesn't matter. You evoke that deliberately, and that image reminds you of something which is heartfelt and open-hearted, and you do that quite deliberately. And you might do that for 10 minutes, half an hour, 4 to 5 minutes, call it a practice. And what happens if you do that? So let's say if I do that with, I do that a lot with my mother, I can, obviously, because I'm with her so much, I can really imagine her in her little red morning coat. Looks like a little teddy bear. And I can imagine that very easily, but I don't go to the narrative. I don't go to a narrative. I go to the sense of kindness, right? And then I keep using the same structures of mind that we have, because we have memory, right? And that memory can be both narrative and heart and emotional. So I can have the memory of something that I've done which is unskillful, that brings a certain result, but I can bring forth something which is skillful. So I can visualize, imagine a loving connection, an open-hearted connection, a connection of amity, friendliness. I can evoke that, I can hold that in the heart, and I can do that and do that and do that. And that can become an abiding in balance. Why? Why is that different than, say, the negative? Well, because it doesn't have to engage thought, and it's done deliberately. So I evoke the sense of kindness, compassion towards my mother, and I bring that into the heart, and then I hold it there, but in silence. And that creates a kind of balance, an emotional balance. If I go into sentimentality, if I go into worry, then that's not here. It's usually up in the head. It's not in the heart. So doing that for a while, builds up a certain balance in the citta, in the heart, of open-heartedness. Now, when the negative things come, now, if some negative memory comes, then because the heart has some balance around that, it knows the mind is now going into negative thought. And there's a way of returning to that balance and letting go of the thought, because oh, that's just a memory. So memory and is terribly important in understanding the mind. Our perceptions are built on memory. We need memory. But memory, when it is not known as simply in a subjective way, keeps taking us off into negativity if we're not mindful. So we like around that habit, and there's a lot in our lack of samadhi, in nicca samadhi, and lack of balance, which is just around that one problem of having a negative perception, a negative memory, a negative feeling rising in consciousness, and then being held, attached, preoccupied with that kind of thinking. And that might be around your self-perceptions. It might be around the way another person works or the way they function. And there's just that memory triggers that off. Our architect who designed and helped build the monastery in the meditation hall in New Zealand, if you remember the story of that he got an award for the best building in New Zealand in that category by the Architects Association. Now that to me, that was an amazing award to get that for that year. So it was obviously a beautiful building. And I remember asking, I said, "So when you come in here, what do you see?" He said, "I have to be very careful not to remember the mistakes." So his mind could see that corner and that corner, because he had designed it, and there were some perceived mistakes. I didn't see them. Maybe Kusla did. I didn't see them. So you could see his with you could see how that could happen. He would go into the hall. He would see one piece of whatever, one corner of the hall. He would get the negative memory, should have done it different. He would hold on, if he was unskillful, he would hold on to the negative impression and not like the hall, even though he got an award, right? But he's a meditation teacher, and he didn't fall for that. But that'd be very easy to do. We can do that with ourselves. We can have something we feel is inadequate, and everyone will tell us, and then we'll agree with them, and and there'll be a sense that we always have to be perfect for everyone, and then we'll dwell on that. We'll easily just that'll just come up. Just like that little bit, and the mind will dwell on that. if there's, you know, we're all trying to be better people, but you could see how just that lack of awareness, lack of samasamadhi, would always take the negative, believe in it, and then run with it. And then the mind would be caught up with the khandhas. Now, it's not just about, you know, negativity. It's about being caught by the khandhas, being always preoccupied with thought and emotion, and the mind never stepping back into a kind of witnessing posture of equanimity and seeing process. There's always the involvement with it, always the involvement with it. I read a good piece about modern shopping, how it makes you unhappy because of options. So let's say you want to get yourself a new fridge, and you need a new fridge. Your old fridge is packing up, and so you kind of you do your online search, and then you go and you buy it, and they deliver it, and then suddenly you notice, if I would have got the other model, you know, then the door would have been in the fridge and the butter and the it would have been better. And there's that sense of disappointment. And then if you look at that fridge, there's a sense, oh, I got the wrong one. I should have got the other. I got the wrong one. Each time you saw that bit of critical element. Now, the fact that only 1% of 1% of the planet can have such a good refrigerator might escape your notice. So actually getting something quite good could lead to a sense of disappointment. This is modern shopping because of options. This is quite a good article kind of pointing to that. But if you saw that, if you saw that, I should have got model X rather than model B, and you saw that negativity arise, and then you made a choice. You know, you made a choice not to just dwell on that, and say, oh, it's good enough or whatever. I mean, you could change it and all that, but that's another scenario. But why? Not just for the sake of somehow being appeased by your rational mind, but for the sake of this non-fascination with the khandhas. It's just endless, you know, it's endless trying to get it right. Trying to get it, you know, get your own personality organized to the right kind of structures and the conventional world. It's just endless. It goes on and on, doesn't it? Why? Because it's always bigger than us, and it's never quite right. It's never quite what you imagined, people. So the project in Buddhism is to do the best you can, but to remember that the emotional world, the world of things, is always fraught with instability, and it's not sure. And to actually notice that in your mind, how, like, when disappointment arises, so you can know that. You can know that disappointment and not just keep perpetuating the tendency to believe in disappointment. Otherwise, there's no freedom. So the metta practice that we do is meant to bring your heart to a sense of emotional balance, where there's a sense of peace and open-heartedness. And that's not passion, it's amity, it's like goodwill, those kinds of things. And then learning to train in that sense of emotional balance. And then when the mind is, when you're challenged in some kind of way, you've got like a platform of balance to work from. If you don't have a platform of balance, you're just kind of bouncing around. Every now and then, there certainly is the open heart when conditions are right, but then when conditions aren't wrong, then it's something else. But we're quite deliberately trying to train in the sense of open-heartedness. If you think about the Karanya Metta Sutta or the teachings on the Brahma Viharas in so many different ways, this is terribly important, really important. So that doesn't deny the tendency to go towards negativity in minor or major ways, but it's a way of finding balance so you know that. You know that. And that's a very quiet state of mind. It's not like you're not thinking about someone all the time, because that's thought. It's a state of consciousness which comes from the center of your chest rather than from the center of your cerebellum. And you can actually do that. You can notice your thinking mind. You can feel your thinking mind start to go down a critical pathway, critical in the sense of averse. And you can bring your attention down to here. You can do that. You can bring it back to balance if you've trained in that way. Not through sentimentality, but just through samasamadhi, you know, right training of the heart. And then that sense of amity, then, because it knows aversion as aversion and doesn't get caught up into it, leads to more and more peacefulness. It's more and more peacefulness, more and more peacefulness. And then that steadiness of heart, you can see how that, like, it's pointing to samasamadhi, steadiness, balance, where there's no longer the fascination with the khandhas. And I think you could see that that's a necessary pathway for the deeper spiritual possibilities of not grasping the khandhas, not getting caught up with the khandhas. So that's one way to look at those. The other, the doubt, usually the fifth hindrance, if you look at the nature of doubt, there is doubt which is skillful. So Venerable Attalo thought there was a fire, and he, you know, because there was a smell. What he discovered later was that I had lit some incense, but he didn't know. But you know, now if he has that doubt, I think it's a fire, and he said, "Oh, I'm just watching doubt," and the house burns down. This is not good. So just to say the doubt is wrong, right? That would not be what we're talking about, the hindrances. There's nothing right or wrong about doubt. Doubt is a very necessary part of surviving in life. So you have a doubt, you know, there's a leak, you hear some dripping in the roof, you go and check it, rather than just sit, oh, it's just drip, drip, drip. In the hearing, there is just the hearing, no doubt. So and doubt is a good tool for inquiry. Like you're kind of reacting to someone very strongly. You can, why am I reacting that way? You watch and you observe. So it's a kind of stepping stone towards observing cause and effect. So doubt there can be skillful, but the doubt that's unskillful is one where your mind never settles into just observing. It always needs to analyze. So you kind of do a bit of meditation, you think, I wonder if I'm doing it right. You know, I should have tried the other one. Maybe, I don't know. So the mind's always kind of in this analytical doubting, how does it work? I don't know. You never let the practice really work. Never just try. Yeah, I'll try. Oh, but yeah, I don't know if I should try. What does he mean by try? You get that a lot. And so the if you think about, I was talking to someone about contemplating how is the modern psyche conditioned. So I was talking to him about computer screens. So I was thinking, well, people, much of work seems to be in front of a computer screen. So it must be eye-centered, looking out, looking for something. And then he added to that, yeah, and it's always analyzing. It's kind of saying, which way should we go? Some more of that, less of that. So in terms of meditation, if that's what your mind is doing, you're kind of looking at the breath and trying to figure it out, and how do I do this? Then your mind never kind of relaxes into sort of receptive mode. It's always trying to do something, figure something out, and see if it works. Do something else. So there's a strong sense of me analyzing, figuring out. And that strong sense of me thinking can lead, trying to figure it out, it's a lot of thinking, doubting, am I doing it right? And the mind never has a chance just watch the breath for 10 minutes. 2 minutes later, oh, where should I watch the breath? Should I watch it? Well, one Ajahn said at the end of the out-breath, the other one said to count. I'll count. Six. I wonder when I started to count. So it never really settles, and that's in thought. And that's because we have a lot of habit of trying to figure things out. And we're very, especially our culture, we, you know, most of us have, you know, read a lot, and we have a lot of kind of analytical skills. And then that, because that sometimes that's the main way we've used our mind, just to trust, say, just to trust one breath at a time, just to trust that your intentions will take you there, just to trust in sila, things like that. That sometimes isn't as strong. So we're not the people, like non-traditional Buddhists who come to, say, Theravada Buddhism, usually not so much faith-oriented as punya-oriented. You know, they have more the intellectual approach. Whereas, like, I was told that some of the villages of Ajahn Chah's, around Ajahn Chah's monastery, that a lot of the lay people were really terrific meditators because they had tremendous faith, and he was a very good teacher. So he could really guide them quite easily. And he would sometimes say, you know, you Westerners, you know, you're just like us. You got a nose and eyes. You just think more. So if you have a very kind of strong trying to figure it out mind, that will constantly tend to take you into analysis and doubt, analysis and doubt. And that kind of analysis and doubt, usually one question leads to another, leads to an answer leads to a question, kind of over-information. So mind, which is observing cause and effect, and sees cause and effect, sees good results and bad results, can be quite silent. You can drop in a question, but then you watch. Just watch with the breath. So the attachment to intellect would be when you don't know, when you're not sure, then you try to figure it out with thought, rather than knowing, this is a feeling of not being sure. And when you know the feeling of not being sure, you can make a choice, either to think or not think. It's rather like I feel the negative perception of having purchased the wrong thing or the meditation hall. That negative perception memory comes into mind. And if I'm mindful, there's some samadhi or balance, like in a kind of nor ordinary life kind of way, then I can make a choice. I can choose not to simply focus on that negative memory. I can go somewhere else. So the architect does that. And the same with that kind of doubting mind. If you have a sense that it's okay not to know, it's okay to just to trust the process and see what happens, then every time doubt comes up, you don't have to be the victim of it. And that's around right intelligence. So too much intelligence could make you too restless, just like trying to figure it out all the time. So that's around one way of looking at this. So the other two around restlessness and dullness. I mean, typically you find that, like, restlessness can be just a lot of flurried thinking. Just always the mind, always planning something or organizing something or creating something. Just always needing to mull the past or the future over. Just kind of this flurry of mental activity. The other, the dullness bit, you notice most in meditation is just this, the mind, the kind of inability to remain bright. The mind just keeps drifting into dull states of mind. And that, to me, is a kind of energy issue to some extent. So if it's the dull part of our mind in meditation, which is a very common, I mean, in monastic communities, partially it's exhaustion. So sometimes people just don't get enough sleep. And then it's time to have a snooze, as my mother says. Snooze is good. And so, like in meditation, I think you'll see that sometimes if you're doing a day of meditation and you're feeling dull after the meal, you just have a kind of power nap for half an hour, you're quite enlivened, feel quite bright, and you can meditate for quite a few hours. So there's that kind of dullness that sometimes you... But there's also a kind of dullness which is just like the habit of falling into quasi-pleasant states of mind. Not even pleasant, just the mind just kind of dropping off. I'm just kind of falling into a low energy. And there, the capacity to know the body is terribly important, to have mindfulness of the body. So sammasamadhi there is the embodied mindfulness. Your attention isn't just always in thought. It has a basis in posture, in breathing, in the heart, in the throat. You're really embodied, just like you can live more from the heart than from the head, literally. That sounds like a kind of a New Age cliche, but you can function daily, moment by moment, from here, from the center of the chest, as you, and then you can function from the middle of the thinking process. You can actually physically feel that, because the awareness can be embodied in that place. And the same, the kind of overall embodiment of attention into the body, into the posture, into the breathing, into the neck, into the spine, and all that is a part of a kind of vitality you need to bring into meditation. You can't, if you don't embody your practice, what happens is, unless you're very, very skillful, you just tend to drift into thinking, and the thinking kind of takes you down into a dull place. So, classically, just holding your body up, that's why sitting practice is a lot easier than say, lying practice, just being able to hold your body up. And then seeing, and it's the same principle then, that you can see dullness as an object of mind. To see the negative memory as an object, to see dullness of mind as an object, that's very hard, because the mind just goes off, it just gets so quickly there. And so how do you notice that? So sammasamadhi, balance, if you look at balance, what's imbalance is there is not a capacity to see dullness as an object. You become this dull subject, dulled by it. The other, and around dullness, the pelvis tilted forward, the spine being strong, the chest being open, the head being tall, eyes open, all those are the kind of classic things that you constantly hear about. But even though you hear about them, you have to do them. So somehow you have to diagnose that there is dullness if you're going to really train the mind in meditation, because that will be a hindrance which will come up. And then you have to really learn how to use the body to not get caught up in that. And you could see that if you want to deepen this practice and take it to the deep places of silence in your heart, if every time you meditate, the mind just goes into dullness, then that's where you're caught by the khandhas. That's the particular energy system that grabs your attention and kidnaps it, and you don't have free attention anymore. Attention's not available anymore. It's just caught. Restlessness is the other kind of energy thing, and that usually isn't just a lot of thinking. The mind just kind of going to thought all the time. So you're not dull. I mean, you keep looking at the clock and so on, but it's just this need to think all the time, just to analyze and so on. So sammasamadhi would be, what's the imbalance there? The mind always needs to think. Why? Why does it always have to go to thought? So you have to learn to see, first of all, the thought as an object. You have to wake up to that. And you have to see what the mood of the mind is that needs to think. So the mood of the mind conditions the thinking. So then, and usually it's around something that you're going to do, or that you've done in the past. And the mind just keeps thinking. And so the way to deal with that is one of the ways is to try to notice simple things like no thought, like to actually begin to consciously notice no thought. So like the way I like to talk about the start of meditation, I say, just listen. I've been, I've started the group at Ottawa U. We have a beginner's meditation there, which is quite good this year. We got 30 people. It's quite good. But the next to us, in the room next to us, they were having some other function, and there were about 40 people in the other room, and a speech and clapping, and whoopee, and a speech and clapping, and that kind of energy. And we're all sitting there, and then the door, one of the doors of our hall, every time the door in the other hall would open, ours would open. So you constantly get this boom, boom, click, boom, click, boom, and then, and I'm trying to teach listening, right? It's a bit of a, so I said, yeah, okay, now listen to thought, and see how unpleasant that is. Is that unpleasant? And then can you notice the unpleasantness of a door opening, shutting? And we tried to fix it. And to actually just listen to the unpleasant. And listening is very good to bring you to no thought. So there was actually quite an easy way to teach. So what's the problem? Is it the door and the sound of the whoopee next door? Or is it the not wanting of that? So it's kind of, it's a nice one to teach. But if you learn to like to come to no thought, you know, just in little gaps, very, very helpful, just little gaps, really recognize no thought. Don't try to get rid of thought, but recognize it as an aspect of consciousness. So just listen. Like. Or if you use nature, say, and you see the golden colors of a maple tree, to actually just allow that image to come to you rather than saying, oh, isn't it lovely, it's golden. Because then you're not looking at the tree. You're into description again, which is fine. But actually, deliberately learn to abide in no thought. By listening, by looking. So there's just the hearing, just this way. And then learn how to sustain that for a span. Just a little span, like just a count of 10, just listening. But notice no thought. And there, now you're not trying to get rid of thought. You're just noticing no thought. And then use something like color. And let the color come to you. Let it come to you. Notice no thought. So you train. And this is, again, this idea of balance. You train in the balance of no thought. It feels this way. So then your awareness is available. You're not kidnapped. It's not under. They train in this balance of no thought. And so when thinking comes up, you tend to notice thinking as an object more, rather than being caught up in the thinking processes. And then that is what settles the mind, you know, that kind of that restlessness of always thinking. And then as you notice thought more as an object, then you'll notice what the underlying mood of the mind is, what the cause of it is. If it's planning, if it's worrying, you know, you have some really difficult situation you're going to have to sort out. We're always kind of figuring out, if I do this, then I do that. If I do this, then I do that. You begin to, like, well, what's the underlying energy? What's the mood of the mind that conditions all that thinking? And then that takes you back to the body. You know, you notice the mood of the mind is conditioning both the thinking process and the bodily processes. So the mood of anxiety shortens the breath, makes it tight, etc., etc. And then you begin to link the two, the thinking mind, the tight body, and you begin to find balance in body-mind. You learn to go to no thought. You learn how to maybe deepen your breath to calm it all down. And you see that then if you calm the breath, you calm the thinking mind, and they both work together. But if, and they're working together not in a way that you're trying to achieve anything, it's more like a return to balance. So like sometimes, if you imagine riding a bicycle, you know, if you're going over rough terrain, you just got to really hold on to the handlebars. And then you get on a smooth bit, oh, you can let go of the handlebars. Because yeah? There's a lot of balance, and you don't need to touch it very much. Not that I can do that. I see people doing that, it's really neat. So sometimes you get some, you know, pretty rough stuff coming up, and then you have to really pay attention. You know, your mind, you know, might wants to go into some, say, negative thing about someone else. It really wants to go there. You have to be very careful. Back to the heart. What is it doing? Some negative thing towards yourself. Back. Keep going back. Making strong intentions. To make strong intentions. But oftentimes it's not so, you know, it's just very ho-hum. And you still have to make intentions, but it's much lighter. It's a much lighter. What's no thought? What's sound like? And the more we practice balance, the more balanced we are. And the more we notice imbalance, the less we practice balance, then imbalance is just, you know, it's kind of the way we are. So if you look at it as like sama samadhi is being balance, and you're just returning to balance, and it's very doable in an ordinary kind of life. When one reads sometimes about samadhi, the high states of mind can sound so impossible, sort of unreachable. And in meditation retreats and so on, we can discover, you know, amazing places of concentration. But in ordinary life, how does sama samadhi work in ordinary life? When you're with people, when you're working, how is it? And I think this way, I at least find it. Can I sustain balance? If I understand what balance is, how can I sustain that and work with those places that my heart experiences imbalance? Then it's very doable. You know, it's a kind of ongoing thing, not just a thing you do on retreat. All right, I'll leave that for your thoughts.